Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Hello, Rachel. I am doing extremely well. I'm doing yum yum, as Lou Welch would have said in this episode. I'm already jumping ahead, Rachel, to that question we always ask of which character in an episode of Babylon 5 would have said yum yum if written by the Star Trek Discovery writers. I'm already jumping ahead. It's Lou Welch. He would have said yum yum at that delicious burger he was eating. He was chowing that down. But I'm all over the place, Rachel. I'm super excited because we're talking Babylon 5. We're the Yum Yum podcast because of that iconic line of dialogue, Yum Yum, from Star Trek Discovery, a show that we have previously covered on this podcast. But while we're waiting for that new season to start and finish so we can rewatch it and talk about it, we're talking Babylon 5. We're talking the 1990s Babylon 5.
A universe devastated by war has only one last hope for peace. Space Station Babylon 5.
So, Rachel, we're rewatching the series, so that does mean we're heavy spoilers. If people have not seen this show before, you should see it because we like to discuss it from having rewatched this show multiple times and looking at it again and seeing what little details we're noticing upon this viewing of it. So that is people's warning. If you have not seen Babylon 5 before, you're going to get spoiled on the details. I know you're thinking to yourself, how can you spoil stuff down the line with the episode Eyes very easily? I mean, did you watch Eyes? This episode's all about re-examining its own self. So of course we can do the same with it. But Rachel,
mm-hmm.
We're not alone.
No.
We had to bring somebody in. We had to bring some eyes in, some internal investigations in. I still can't get over the fact that the episode is called Eyes because they're watching them, but they're also the double eyes, internal investigations. It's very funny to me that the episode half-heartedly points that out halfway through. It's like, yeah, they're all eyes.
Yeah, Garibaldi just drops it.
Yes, so Rachel, tell us who we're joined by and let them come in. Let them in the yum-yum.
You're just going too hard on the yum-yums, Ryan.
Star Trek Discovery's writing staff would want me to go hard on the yum-yums.
They only do the yum-yum once.
And isn't it the most infamous moment in its entire run? Exactly.
We are joined by a fellow podcaster, John.
Hello, John.
Greetings and Yum Yum Saturday to all of you. But I understand that you're on Yum Yum Sunday because we're on other sides of the world. So greetings from the past to the future.
Greetings to you, John.
And then the episode comes out on a Yum Yum Friday.
Good eating to you, John. John, you are from a Star Trek podcast, not a Babylon 5 podcast. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, certainly. So my show is called Trek Profiles. And what I do is I actually interview Star Trek fans about their connection to the show, how they found it. Did they always watch it or did they come to it at some later point in their life? Why they love it and what it means to them. So it's actually a Star Trek podcast, not actually about Star Trek. It's actually about the fans and what their connection is to the show. And typically we take a dive into their fandom experience. You know, are they collectors or do they go do cosplays or anything like that? And then we talk about the episodes that personally affect them in some way, that they feel a connection to or speak to them in some personally profound way. And then we have each guest faces my Kobayashi Maru lightning round, where they get five terrible multiple choice questions that they have to answer. And it's generally a blast. And I put out an episode a month, and I've been doing it since 2018 now, so over 3 years, and we're still going strong. I've just dropped episode 58, I believe. So that is available wherever you get your audio or at trekprofiles.com.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show. We were talking off mic before about how I actually have a hard time getting into Star Trek podcasts because a lot of the terrain is very similar, a lot of the approaches, a lot of the conversations. Everyone loves these five episodes and all of that stuff. But I do like your show because you get a real personal touch. It's about the connections people individually have with the franchise of Star Trek, and then it spirals out into the broader spectrum of science fiction and television and art and all of that stuff. So yeah, like, you talk about Star Trek, but yeah, you get to talk about other aspects of life and connections to media, and it's really engaging in that manner, because yeah, it's always good, like, people can listen to our show in which we break down individual episodes of Star Trek Discovery, but there's also something really cool about hearing you interview just, you know, any, you know, individual people about their life and their connection to Star Trek. And it just kind of shows you that Star Trek and TV shows, like for us, like Babylon 5, can really have a deep impact on an individual person. It's really cool.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I've told the story before, but when a podcasting network approached me about doing a podcast for them, my initial response was no. And it's not because I have any issues with doing technology stuff or recording. I actually do some of this as far as my work. I do a little bit of audio recording, and, you know, I'm very technically adept. So none of that stuff was the issue. It was really that everything was being done, in my opinion, right? If you wanted rewatch shows, there's tons of rewatch shows. There's tons of people analyzing. There's tons of people talking about what it all means and doing different kinds of, you know, there's news shows about Star Trek. And one day it just occurred to me, I was listening to another podcast that has nothing to do with Star Trek, and the host was talking about the community that he built around his podcast. And that's when I suddenly realized that I could do a podcast that would not be about Star Trek, but would be about the community. And that's when the whole show kind of sprung into my head, pretty much completely formed. You know, the whole template has not changed really from the beginning. I've made a few tweaks to a few little things here and there, but pretty much the episode one is pretty much like episode 58 as far as like how I do it and all of that. So it's it sprung from my head like, you know, the goddess from the head of Zeus, right? Fully formed, right? Perhaps I inflate myself too much. So I should stop there.
we obviously discussing and rewatching Babylon 5. And for myself, even though there have been several Babylon 5 podcasts, it always feels like there could always be more in-depth Babylon 5 analysis, and especially on individual episode basis. And then as soon as we started doing it, other podcasts started forming, the HD remasters came out, everyone's involved and interested in Babylon 5, of people who are lifelong Trek fans going, you know, I always heard that Babylon 5 show was actually worth giving a shot, and we should give it a chance. And I, you know, I'm going to push my DS9 affection aside and give it a shot. And now there's a reboot in the works, and such a crazy time. And I was just curious of what's been your history with Babylon 5 as a show. Were you there when it first started? Did you see it later in life? What's your relationship with Babylon 5, the series?
Yeah, so I was around and watching TV and a sci-fi fan when the show originally came on, but I wasn't aware of it when The Gathering came on and in the first season, and maybe I think into the second season. So I was in the Navy actually at the time, and I was on a ship in the Navy. I wasn't part of the Navy that hangs out on land and doesn't really know where the piers are. I was in the actual seagoing Navy, which is a rarity. And we were out to sea pretty much all the time. So I never got a chance to really watch the show. I may have heard about it. And when my time was up, and I rejoined the civilian world, I moved to a part of the country that I had never been in, because I got a good job there. So, but I knew no people. I would go to work, and I started university classes at night, and that was it. That was my life, you know, living in a little apartment. So I had, you know, plenty of time to indulge myself with TV. And I think I started Babylon 5 just by turning it on because it was on, and I figured, oh, this is sci-fi, I might like it. And this was probably towards the end of season two, early season three. And at the time, this was in the dial-up internet days. So you didn't exactly just, you know, get on social media and start talking about it. But there was a series of internet email fanzines that were going around. And there was one that I somehow found, don't even ask me how, called the Zocalo, which came out weekly. And it was a weekly email news magazine, you know, in text that just, you know, people would contribute articles and, you know, you could sign up and get it delivered to your email box. And I started listening to that, or reading that, I should say. And an article came in that had the email address of a guy who was at my school, my university that I was going to. So I, you know, when you're in the university, you have ways of getting in touch with each other, you know, and there's student directories and all that. So I contacted this guy and I was like, hey, I saw your article in the Zocalo. I'm a fan too. And he's like, really? That's great. I was like, yeah, I missed the first season and a half or two seasons or whatever. He's like, oh, no problem. I got the videotapes. Come find me in, you know, this building, you know, whatever. And so I went to him and he had all the episodes on videotape that I'd missed. And I was able to like binge the whole show and get current, late season two, early season three. I don't remember where it was. And I watched it all in real time after that.
Oh, that's so amazing. That's just so cool. When it comes to our history, that we obviously grew up when it was all finished and done. Mm-hmm. But I remember my parents, they had all their videotapes of recording it on TV and having to try and catch it as it got pushed back later in the night, as Australian TV used to do a lot with science fiction shows and just move the time around. And it's one of the few shows that I remember my parents obsessing over. There was many a times in which when they were trying to catch it up or they hadn't watched it in a while, they were like pausing frames and being like, I reckon we could figure out a clue in this image here, which they did. They were smart enough to figure out what Kosh looked like before we got to see what Kosh looked like, just from some
awesome
clues in the visuals and all of that. Like, look, we can see in Leader's eyes and all this kind of shit. And so my parents got nerdy about that. It's one of the few shows they get that nerdy about. It's
always
cool.
Was right there. I was just as nerdy. I was right there with them.
We must know who is loyal to Earth, Ross. And who isn't?
As commander of Babylon 5, I personally vouch for the loyalty of every member of my staff, and I resent your tactics. You have no right to snoop around the station without my knowledge.
I have every right, Commander. My authority comes directly from the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
So, we are covering episode 16 of season 1, called Eyes, and I have the DVD description in front of me to read out, because why read IMDb's description when we have these DVDs? Who wrote these descriptions? I don't know. I'll have to say it's JMS. He has his hands and everything. It must be him. They don't credit anyone else. So let's just assume JMS himself wrote this description, which goes as such. Does Sinclair have something to hide? An Earth Force Colonel, Gregory Martin, takes command of the station when Sinclair and his frontline officers refuse to submit to a Psi-Corps loyalty mind scan. But maybe the individual with something to hide is the new commander. That is the description of the episode, Eyes. John, since you're our guest, I'll ask you first, what's been your relationship and history with this particular episode of B5?
This certainly would have been one of the ones that I saw on the videotapes from my schoolmate. And I did have the binge experience of season one and going into part of season two. And so I actually really enjoyed this episode. What I found out about it that was interesting was that it was actually the last one filmed in season one, chronologically in the production schedule. And that's because it's basically an episode with a bunch of people in a room talking. There's no big special effects. There's no space battles or, you know, any sort of thing like that. So they could do this episode when they had no money left in the budget, right? They just had a couple guest stars with all their regular sets and all that. And sometimes when these constraints happen where they're forced to do what they call a bottle episode, you can see that it's really just them trying to get through the day. But I thought the episode was just spectacular, and I thought they just did a wonderful job with it. So I'm a fan of the episode, and I was excited when you asked me to be on to talk about it.
Rachel, what about you? You've seen this. What did you think of it that first time, and how do you feel about it overall?
I enjoyed it the first time, but I remember being like, why are they doing this weird sort of retrospective episode when they're halfway through the first season? Mm-hmm. I was like, This doesn't feel like it belongs here.
Yeah.
On the first watch, I was just like, but why now? And now I'm like, oh yeah, like it makes sense and it has to go here because of all of these other things that happen. And then on this viewing, I'm like, this is just really solid.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed this episode too. I have always just liked it. It's never been one that's majorly stuck with me, and I've always had some issues with it overall, but upon rewatching this, I don't know, I think it does come in at an interesting time in the show. I think it is an interesting move narratively to have an episode thrown in there that is questioning all of the decisions made thus far by the characters and aka the writers of the show, to actually have an episode sit down and look at the decisions made and say, was that the right call there? Is this actually good? And obviously there's an agenda to it from the character that's doing it, but I've always thought it's just a solid episode, and it's always one that I like to think of about what was good about Commander Sinclair as a character. There's a few episodes in season one, like By Any Means Necessary as well, in which it's just a great example of what was Commander Sinclair's strengths as a leader? What was his command style like? What was he like as a character?
Yeah, and we've discussed his journey from kind of being more reckless to reserved and to where he is in this episode, where it's very much he studies the rules and uses the bureaucracy for his own means. Yeah.
And so I often would point to this episode as well as a great example of what I like about the character of Commander Sinclair. A little while ago, our good friend Bartek, he said his favorite character in Babylon 5 was Angry Sinclair. And this is also a great example of pissed off Angry Sinclair, which is also a favorite character of mine as well.
I face death on the line. Where were you, Colonel? Picking trash out of garbage cans to prove who was loyal and who wasn't?
So what was it like for you? I'm just curious to just broach this subject for a minor moment. What was it like for you to come back to season one and there was a different guy?
Oh, gosh. The thing was, is that I had already known that because I had been following along that email zine, and there'd been so much discussion about all of that. So it wasn't a surprise to me in any way. I think that when I watched the episodes, I wasn't aware of, you know, that there were some behind the scenes stuff. I had just assumed it was all part of the grand plan.
Okay.
You know, and we found out later that it wasn't, and there were some other things involved, which maybe we can get into if you want. But I just thought it was all part of the plan. And I'm very much a go with the flow kind of person on this stuff. So I enjoyed it. I said, okay, here's Sinclair. And, you know, now there's no Sinclair. Now we got Sheridan and it's all good. And we move ahead. Because frankly, one of the things I really like about B5 is that as a veteran, there's a lot of military stuff that sort of makes sense to me in the show.
Mm.
And one of those things is like people come and go all the time on the ship. It is normal. You have a new captain like every 18 months. You have a new executive officer. You have new division officers. You have new, you know, people on your in your team, you know, or on your watch bill. I mean,
yeah, there's always a slightly different crew.
Yeah,
always.
But then there's like those people who are like, oh, no, I am a part of this team.
Yeah, you have your Lou Welches who come and go.
Yeah, it's absolutely normal, you know. And I remember, you know, if you want to divert for just half a second, but I remembered reading stories of how unusual it was for, I think when I was in, there was a story about a guy who was retiring who was on an aircraft carrier, and he'd spent his entire 20-year career on that one ship. And that was considered deeply, deeply, deeply weird. Like that is not normal. Normally you're on a ship for 2 years, 3 years, and then you're gone, right? You go to a shore command of some kind, right? And then and there's this constant rotating door, revolving door, I should say. So to me, that was totally normal and I was well primed for it. So it did not bother me at all.
Fair enough. It is one of those things that people have a weird relationship with season one, because it's that thing of, when I watched it, obviously I grew attached to Sinclair because I had watched the season so many times in isolation. But my general vibe is people being like, well, Sinclair's the placeholder character. And I get bummed out by that, because an episode like this really shows me why he was a great lead character. I like his way of approaching conflicts. And we'll talk about that a bit later on as we delve into the conflict of the episode, which is Ari Benzane, the greatest villain name ever. All three names, Ari Benzane. Perfect.
Are we first going to talk about the real cutie of this episode?
Oh, yeah. Can we talk about the bike plot, the motorcycle plot in this? The little
detour? Is so cute.
Lanier
it's so cute
is
and so earnest.
So adorable. And his excitement over the history and, like, him learning Japanese so that he can read the manual.
Sexual prowess and rebellion.
And you can see his eyes getting really big, right? As he's looking at the videos and all of that.
Yeah, this we've had on our rewatch, Rachel, we've been noting down that Linnea, out of our three attachés, has been the least defined in terms of what they are, what we know them to be as a character. Via, straight out the gate, is what we know Via to be, and he'll grow as a character. Natoth, straight out the gate, yeah. Linnea has just been quietly planted in the show, and he'll have little moments here and there.
We already knew that he was a history buff.
We already knew that. He had his moment in Deathwalker in which he told about the Minbari guilt of having Deathwalker give them weapons. But this, to me, is one of the first real avenues of me understanding Linnea as this fun character that we can have fun with. And most of the time we've had him, he's just been a little version of Delenn, like Delenn's little sidekick, but we haven't had a real quiet moment with him. See him have some fun, and pairing him up with Garibaldi, of all people.
Which is something that, like they pair random people with Garibaldi all the time in season one.
Like Delenn in the very first episode at the very end. And so you get this dynamic again, and this has always been, to me, the defining moment of Linnea's character, of like in which I understood who he was. When I first watched this, I went, oh, Linnea fits into place now, because he was always just kind of there, but I didn't really understand why he was in the show and where he fit. But here he was showing us he's the one character in the cast of many who's the real foreigner. He's the outsider. He's this alien who's really appreciating all these new sensations and new sights and new interactions. And I love that type of character in a fantastical setting, because it grounds me in the fantastical setting. Babylon 5 is a marvelous, outlandish, wonderful setting, but without characters like Linnea there, you can kind of lose the tether a little bit. But thankfully you do have characters like Lenny who appreciate, my God, this guy has a motorcycle in his bedroom.
I think one of the things about Lanier the two things really is, there's another episode right about this time. I don't remember the exact sequence, but Grail, when he's talking with Aldous Gaich, and you get the feeling that, or I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the wrong episode. I'm thinking of, Oh goodness. Passing Through Gethsemane. I don't remember now. Where he's talking to one of the monks. And yes, that is Passing Through Gethsemane. Yeah, that's right. And in Passing Through Gethsemane, and you just get the feeling that Linnea is like actively excited about talking about Minbari spirituality. Like he really believes. Like it's not a gig, you know? He is a true capital T believer. And I get the feeling that he would have happily sat there all night talking about that stuff if Edward had let him do it.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about Linnea is him and Veer having those little cocktails.
Yeah.
Yes.
It only happens twice in the show, yet you buy it both times, because they're both very similar characters. They're both the moral compasses of their ambassadors that they serve.
And it just makes so much sense that they would have found each other, and that this is like a weekly thing and we just don't get to see it. And I'm like, I would love it. I would love to see more of it sometimes.
But that's the thing about B5, which is that, you know, they do it once and then they come back to it in season 5, right?
Yeah.
And you know that it's been happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's also like a great thing about the episode we're talking about, Eyes, which is that, you know, it's coming in the middle of season one, but to say, look, Sinclair has made lots of crazy decisions. There's been lots of stuff that's kind of been on the bubble, right? Should he have done this? Should he have done that? And he's being called to account. Like someone's actually gone over the reports and read the reports and been like, what the hell is this guy doing out there in Babylon 5? You know, go sort him out, right?
It matters that something crazy happens like each week on this station. It actually adds up. It's not just like, oh yeah, that's just regular life. It's like, no.
Yeah, it's not regular that Jason Ironheart exists in this show. Like it's not like in Star Trek where Picard each week will encounter crazy situations and blow off the brass so that he can solve it in his way sometimes. Like, this is like, you blew off the brass, Sinclair? Well, we're not happy about that, mister.
They're coming for you.
And of course they're going to come and send an investigation. And of course there's a character who's like, whatever success you had should have been mine. And this should have been my command. So of course that's entirely political and frankly, entirely normal. Because that's how it is. You know, if someone gets appointed to a job in the office, right, there's someone else who was like, that should have been my job.
I saw more death than you could ever conceive of, but I won my battles and I deserved this command. I deserved it. But thanks to those damn Minbari, you got it. Yes, I know all about you and the Minbari, but you won't be doing their bidding much longer. I'm commander of Babylon 5 now. And all your lies won't change that.
With Linnea in this story, I wanted to ask you, Rachel, and ask you, John, about how does a storyline like this, which is purely comedic, it all leads up to probably one of my favorite comedic endings to a Babylon 5 episode ever, which is them riding the motorcycle on the station. How does Babylon 5 manage to implement this type of whimsical, silly humor in an otherwise po-faced story? Because the main plot has lots of serious implications about how fucked up Earth is, the cycle, Ivanova's having nightmares about her mother, and Ivanova's willing to quit, but then also we can cut back to Linnea saying sexual prowess and rebellion, and he's like putting crystals inside of the motorcycle to power it up. How do you think Babylon 5 manages to still make the humor not distract from the drama of the story, John?
The only thing I can say is that it struck me as very true to life. Humans are not always on task, and people can be silly, and people can be serious, and people can have more than one thing going on in their life at a time. And just as an example of this, I will tell you a true story from my own Navy experience. We were on a serious mission. I was on a submarine, and we were on a serious mission doing a serious thing. And it was a several weeks long thing that we were doing. And right in the middle of that, a bunch of people on the ship decided to go steal the executive officer's door and hide it somewhere on the ship and not tell him. So he came back to him and the captain are the only ones who have private cabins on a submarine. That's it. And he comes back and there's no door. And needless to say, he blows a gasket and he's looking for he suspected like a list of, malcontents. And it wasn't them. It was actually the junior officers, which nobody would have guessed. But there was this whole investigation. And I mean, like who's got his door? And he's like, that's it. The chiefs are going to get in trouble. And, we're going to crack skulls. And we're going to do this. We're going to do that. And I'm going to turn the ship upside down. It's like, hey, guys, we're actually here for a serious thing right now. And the fact that you don't have a door is not a big deal. So there was all this insanity going on about the missing door in the middle of this very serious mission that we were doing at the same time, because one particular group of people had a little bit of free time on their hands and decided to create some mischief. So it's an ordinary part of human life, in my opinion. And I thought it was just great.
It adds to the whole thing of this is a whole station with people who have their own lives, and they're all in different stages of hecticness or emotional turmoil. And it's Linnea just has some downtime. Delenn is off the station. He doesn't have much to do. He's a history buff. He just completely just happens upon Garibaldi doing this. It really is just everybody has their own shit going on. And I think another part of it is because it feels right for Linnea.
Yeah.
It's just all of the characters in this episode are being themselves. They're being true to what they've been set up as. And it's just making them feel more solid as people. And it's doing that same thing with Linnea, but in a very different way.
I agree 100%. It adds a realism and a humanity to all of these characters. Hearing that Garibaldi is scrounging for parts all of these years to make a motorcycle feels like something he would do. And it's not as if we needed to hear about this in previous episodes. Being introduced it here, and we never really see this bike ever again, doesn't matter, because once you hear it and once you see Garibaldi get on the bike and go vroom, 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 you smile and go, oh, that's right, he's a dork. He's a cop, but he's a dork. This is a guy who likes Looney Tunes. This is a guy who likes Bunya Carter. This is Garibaldi. This is Michael Alfredo Garibaldi. And you're right, Lanier's enthusiasm is so fun because he's been very reserved thus far, but he's been keen, but he's been reserved. And this is the first time in the season thus far in which we get to see him fully unload this enthusiasm, much to the chagrin of Garibaldi. But then Garibaldi was also like, oh, well, it's done. It's pretty neat. Too bad we can't ride it. Oh, no, we can ride it.
Yeah. Like, that's the bit that, like, saves it for Garibaldi, because he's just like, it was just a puzzle. He wanted to be working on the puzzle. He never thought that he would really get it done.
Yeah.
Two things I'd say about this, which is first that I think that it's a great example of how Lanier has to have Delenn gone from the station for this to happen. I think that was absolutely right in that he sees himself as like Delenn's assistant. And it's only when she's off station that he's sort of left to fend for himself that he allows himself to get involved with this. Like if Delenn had been around, like I don't think would have even engaged with the motorcycle. He would have been like, I have to go see what Delenn wants and do whatever she gives me to do. The other thing is that I love this idea that we were talking about before, that you have to remember that it's a big station, as Rachel said, right? There's people coming and going and stuff happening that has nothing to do with any of this stuff at the senior level command staff. And my favorite example of this across another fandom is from the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Did you all ever watch that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that episode, I think it's called The Body, where she discovers her mother had passed away.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful scene when Buffy walks in the living room of the house and she sees her mother's body. And if you pay very close attention to the scene, you hear kids laughing and playing outside.
Yeah.
And it's this very serious moment. You know, she's discovered that her mother has died, but you hear kids laughing and playing because they're 20 feet away and have no knowledge about what's going on inside the house. Right. Nor should they. And I think it's just a great example of that. And this is an example of that, too. You know, there's people at the second level on the ship or on the station that don't even have any awareness of what's going on until Ben Zane tries to take over halfway through the episode, right? That's probably the first they've ever heard of this.
Yeah.
And for the majority of people, this has zero impact on them. Like, mm-hmm. There's millions of people on Babylon 5.
Quarter of a million people.
Oh, sorry. Quarter of a million people at this stage.
Humans and aliens alike.
And you know who has no idea of what's going on?
Linnea.
No, Major Atumbi.
Yeah.
This is one of the few times, I think he's only referred to like three or four times, but he's like the third shift guy on the command deck, right? And he never appears in the show. But he's a command level officer, right? He's running the thing on the night shift, I guess it would be.
This is before we got Corwin. Fully.
But
even though he's here.
No, Corwin's there during the day with Ivanova, right? We never see Major Atumbi. He's a major. He's high up in the command structure. We never see him. He's only talked about. He's like the Vera of Babylon 5.
Station 1, ask Major Atumbi to take my post.
I think it's really rad, actually, that midway through Season 1, it's a big power move that midway through Season 1, they do have high brass people come in and say, enough of this nonsense that you've been doing on this station. We're going to start investigating this. Because I am used to Star Trek and other shows waiting seasons in to minorly reference things that they've done in the past. Like, I think for diehard Trek fans who are seeing this episode, one of the big comparison points one can make is the Drumhead episode of TNG. There's some similarities that you can draw, and they're very different episodes, but that episode seasons into the show and they're referencing events that happened like four episodes ago and that kind of thing. But I think it is a big power move to have halfway through your season call the audience into question and go, have you been watching the show? Have you been paying attention? We have. We have, and
it matters.
Yeah, that's one of the things that obviously I think is the strength of the episode, is the general thing that Babylon 5 has a consistency and a continuity within itself, mm-hmm. which for this era of sci-fi television was still a novel thing, was still something being formed, was still something that was unusual in its own right. And Rachel, when you first watched this episode, you still found that as an unusual thing for yeah. sci-fi TV.
Yeah, I was like, what's this doing here? Like, yeah, like he's done some shady dealings and done things the way that they needed to get done for the right thing to happen, but not necessarily following protocols. And they've drawn attention to the fact that, like, you know, that's just the way that we've had to do it. Like, I really enjoy Garibaldi's line of, like, we've done things by the book, but we've rewritten the book.
Yeah, several times. As a fan of say Star Trek, for example, many times in Star Trek they have to break the Prime Directive, but they do it in a way where they say that they're not, but we the audience know that they are, and they kind of never really. There's many times where they don't actually fully address that they're breaking the rules to save the day in a lot of ways. But I do love in Babylon 5, they always mention it. They always have the repercussions mentioned. They're always saying, hey, you shouldn't have done that, actually. And I don't appreciate that you did that, but what other choice did we have? That's still what makes them the heroes. But I do appreciate that an episode like this comes along and they're saying, do you remember this episode? Do you remember that episode? Well, we remember and we don't appreciate what you did there. I'm going to call in to question your loyalty, because the big thing that is the takeaway of the episode is this is one of the big turning points in season one of letting you know how fucking shit Earth is in this show. Like, we already know it's shit. We already have psychic cops and all of that, but like,
we've
Earth
gotten
government...
our warnings, but this is the first time that we're really seeing how much change they could cause
and how high up in the structure it goes, because we've had the Earth First groups, but those are rogues. But here we are, military people coming in on fellow military people with these obvious agendas here, but it's not being said outright until later in the episode.
Yeah.
There's another angle on the episode that I think is important to look at, though, which is that you have to put yourself back into mid-90s syndicated television to really understand, which is that the show was not on consistently, right? This wasn't like on a streaming network where every Tuesday at, you know, 9 UTC, a new episode dropped. Depending on what town you lived in, it could be on a different local channel in every single town, you know, and you go two towns over, it could be on a completely different network. And it could be preempted by sports. It could be pushed back because of, you know, a weather report, you know, or something else. And so one of the things that episodes like this are really good at is recapping the show without being obvious about it and without burying you in 10 minutes of previously on Babylon 5. So you're getting a nice recap of sort of the season up till now in a way that's authentic and integrated into the show without taking you out of it by, you know, doing previously, which I think is just great. And I don't know how intentional that was. I don't know if JMS was intentional about that or not, but I think it served that purpose really well.
Yeah, I was going to mention that too, of this is a recap episode in a lot of ways, but I am always curious when it comes to these type of recap episodes, what makes them still feel like they're worth watching as an individual episode? Because we've seen those episodes, and say we're decades later from Babylon 5, the landscape of watching things has changed. How come this episode still feels as if it's a whole of its own
rather than like a this, this, and this? It's like a this, and then this, and then this, and then, and we're getting this.
Yeah.
So it's not just stopping to say, hey, look at all of these cool things that we did. It's just like, no, we're just going to like mention this thing because it matters here, and it all has a purpose within the episode.
Yeah, accumulation's the right way to describe it. It doesn't feel like we're halting the pace of the season to just let the people who haven't seen some of it catch up. It does serve as that, but it also serves as a great payoff to the understanding that this show remembers its own rules and its own continuity, because we've had lots of episodes end with Sinclair, you've ruffled some feathers, you've made some enemies, and you just go, yeah, they say that in TV all the time, and we're not really going to see that unless it's a very special episode. But
and it won't be for ages.
It won't be for ages, but then you're midway through the season and this is like after Grail. Whereas like previously on Babylon 5, an old man, David Warner, was looking for the Holy Grail. And then this week it's like, nope, there's George Martin's son is really angry at Sinclair for taking his position because he deserved it, damn it. Yeah, it's a tough line because you still have to present an episode. But this isn't just being an episode. This is an accumulation of things and a recap of things. But I think on the basic level of an episode, the tension is set. You have two bad guys come in. One's obviously a villain and one's obviously kind of not so villainous, who is going to take over the station and they're going to force characters to do things they don't want to do. On that simple, basic level of a plot, it's engaging enough, as well as all of these constraints we're talking about of being a recap and accumulation of things as well. I've got to be honest, I think Ari Ben-Zane's performance is way too over the top and way too out of line, but I kind of love it anyway. How do you feel about it, John?
I knew guys like that when I was in the military.
Yeah.
I knew these hard-charging, ramrod-straight guys, you know, they were all guys who were exactly like that. You know, toe the line, stop right there, mister. You know, I've got a long, I'm wearing a whole bunch of fruit salad on my chest and wearing a bunch of stars on my epaulets. And you better listen to what I have to say because I'm hot stuff and I'm the most Sierra Hotel guy around.
I'm mad at Devin.
I mean, I think he's of a type. You know, the only thing I would say is his hair was a little too shaggy for me, a little too long in the back, a little too much of a mullet, I think. If they'd have given him the buzz cut, I think he would have been even more fit for purpose. I think that I just want to return to one thing you were talking about, which is like, why does this work as a recap episode? And I think it's because the valence of the action is on the present. The recaps serve the purpose of the episode, which is happening in the here and now. And all the stuff in the past is serving to support that. It's not the focus of the episode. And I think that's what makes it work. And if you compare this to an episode like a clip show, like Shades of Grey from Star Trek TNG, that's all about showing you clips from past episodes. Like the here and now stuff is sort of boring. Right? It's all about just showing you clips. Whereas this is really about we're telling a story here and now, and we have some interesting things to remind you of. So come along with us on the journey, and I think that's what makes it good.
I've had enough of this. Your insinuations are bad enough, but when you interfere with the operation of this station...
Sit down, Commander. You haven't been dismissed.
The hell I will. You have a complaint against me, make it. Otherwise, this interview is over.
With Ari Ben-Zane... Rachel, how do you feel about him as an antagonistic character and a representation of the corrupt nature of Earth?
Oh, I completely buy it. And I completely buy him. Because he's just so indignant and so self-serving in a way where he's justifying his self-service by saying that it's self-sacrifice.
I fought on the line.
No, he didn't. He
got this scar leading people into
like
battle.
Like, he's fought on all of these other battles. And it's just like, but that doesn't mean that you deserve anything. You deserve
this position.
You're saying that you've done all of these things for the betterment of Earth and... that you earned this.
Well, one of the things that struck me as very true to life in this is that if you look carefully at the colors, you'll see that Ben-Zane is in the ground forces, right? He's got the brown sort of olive color uniform, whereas Sinclair is in the blue, which is the Flyboys. There always has been and always will be a deep-seated resentment and distrust between those different branches in military service. It always has been, and there always will be. So it doesn't take a lot for me to say, is this ground pounder going to be, you know, buddy-buddy with the Flyboy? Probably not. So I was well-primed to believe that right from the get-go.
Yeah, I've always had a tough time with Ari Ben-Zane because I do understand these real-world things that we are discussing, but also I've seen TV before, and it's very easy to have the guy with the big booming British accent and the massive scar on his face, who's obviously evil from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, I do find him a little bit annoying in some ways, but I really like the performance still. Maybe it's selfish of me. Maybe not selfish. Maybe it's just silly of me to say this, but I love his voice. I could listen to this guy talk for hours. He's just got such a big presence voice-wise. And against somebody, Michael O'Hare, who also has an amazing voice. Two men with big booming voices yelling at one another was entertaining to me. It's not anything fancy, but it is just a truth within me when I watch this episode of seeing these two guys talk military jargon and regulations at each other with booming voices, and you can just feel the testosterone building up between these two guys. They're just and when Sinclair finally releases it and punches him in the fucking face, it's a beautiful payoff, because you've been feeling this boiling up for a lot of the journey along here. But Ari Ben-Zane to me is an interesting setting up point of what we will see of other corrupt Earth Force figures as the show goes along. Because I do feel as the series goes along, they find a way of getting the right amount of energies and levels for these kind of jarheads and corrupt military figures as we go along, in which they still feel like how this guy is, but not as heightened as Ari Ben-Zane. Also, he has a villainous name, Ari Ben-Zane, and his big scar on his face. Like, a part of me just can't take him as seriously as I think the script wants me to. And it does hold me back in some way, shape, or form. And Rachel, you're nodding along. Like, you have similar feelings when you see these type of things happen in TV shows.
Yeah, but the pacing of the episode moves it along so fast that I don't really hold it against it. Mm. It's just like, yeah, you're being a little bit obnoxious and this makes sense. And, you know, it's moving forward. No, yeah, now you got punched in the face. This is all good now.
One of the dynamics I think is really interesting that I noticed on this rewatch that I really appreciated was I actually really liked Ari Ben-Zane and Garibaldi together.
Yeah, and how Garibaldi's like, oh, I don't want to get dragged into this.
It was amazing to me that this hard-charging guy shows up and he's like, Mr. Garibaldi is what I need, you know? And it's like, what? You know, that he would pick this guy who's kind of a screw-up, really, if you look at his record, which I'm sure he did. And he's like, nope, this is the guy I need to be helping me, right? Because it seems genuine. It didn't seem like an angle.
I took it more of sort of an angle of like, I need Garibaldi with me so he can't be off helping Sinclair.
Yeah. I'm taking away your support network.
I need to give him enough of a handicap that he can't get one over on me.
That's how I saw it a bit as well. And also, he, acting-wise, less so script-wise, kind of recognizes how sly of a guy Garibaldi is, and he wants to utilize that for himself in a way. Like, when Garibaldi busts open what Ari Ben-Zane's doing and all of that, he doesn't seem too surprised, Ari Ben-Zane, that Garibaldi busted this open, just from his acting. And so I think it's all of these type of things, but I do think it is, I'm taking away your support network. I'm going to take away your command. I'm going to take away your offices. I'm going to take away your station from you, because I deserve it. Garibaldi should have been my right-hand man, not your right-hand man. Like, it also, I love the Garibaldi dynamic with him, because it does show you how much of a weirdo, bizarro mirror version of Sinclair, Ari Ben-Zane is of Sinclair. This universe in which you imagine if Ari Ben-Zane was in charge of Babylon 5 and how much different it would have been. Because that's
I want to see him negotiating with Londo on something and see how that went.
Yeah, he would have had no time for it. And these damn Minbaris. And just seeing his relationship with Garibaldi, I love scenes in Babylon 5 of characters late at night with their uniforms unbuttoned and unzipped, their hair a mess, they're tired and they're poring through files and they're just talking about details. I love that shit. And this is one of the reasons I love this episode, of seeing these two guys late at night just going through the things and him questioning every decision Sinclair has made.
You see and feel the drudgery.
If you have anything else to ask about the commander's decisions, I suggest you ask him, sir.
I intend to, at 1200. Inform him, then get some sack time. I'll want you there, too.
If I knew who God was, I'd thank her.
One of the things that's interesting about Babylon 5, in comparison to a lot of other shows, a lot of other sci-fi, is our heroes from Earth are part of a system that's failing and is turning into something very disturbing and very mean and vile. And this is one of those episodes in which we really get to have a deeper yeah. understanding of how Earth is not good. They're not good people.
And they all acknowledge that there is something rotten in Earth Force and at Earth Dome.
Yeah.
They don't ignore that, but they're like, that's just the system.
Yeah, John, what's been your feelings about how Babylon 5 has that as an angle in the show, where our people, their version of the Federation is actually bad and actually kind of fucked from the very beginning?
I think that it's refreshing to have a show where we're going to assume that things don't change all that much. Humans are messy. Some people are trying their best. Some are not. And people will always try to subvert power to their own ends. And the question is, what do we do about that when it happens? And I think that it's an eternal story. I mean, you can go into antiquity and find stories just like this.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me at all. I think it's great. And I think that it's an example of reality just in the future, right? That these people are living in a very messy universe, one that is not particularly tidy. And I appreciate that and kind of like it. I think it gives a lot of layers to how our characters have to maneuver in this universe.
Yeah, I still am a taken aback, honestly, because I am so used to some of these aspects, say with Star Wars, where we know the Empire is bad and this is this, but it still feels in the background or as a backdrop rather than an actual thing that we're going to be confronting head on and actually delve into all the layers and nuances. And I always appreciate that Babylon 5 does that. When I was stuck with this season alone and I watched this episode, it really did irk me that Earth is being represented in a way that felt true to life, because a part of sci-fi joy is that level of escapism, and you have the pitch of the show, right? We're a space station and we're trying to get peace to happen. And you assume, well, the people who made the station are obviously trying to be peaceful, right? And they're not. Earth is very disinterested in the idea of peace at this point in the show. And we'll see it get worse and worse and eventually break out into a whole entire thing. But when I see a character like Ari Ben-Zane throwing his weight around, it gives you this sense of, oh, far out, people back home are bad. But then I appreciate that Mr. Gray, someone who's a part of an organization we know already to be very evil and very disgusting with the Psi-Corps, we get to see a character like him, and he is completely different to every other kind of Psi-Corps person we've met. He seems like a genuinely good person, and it gives you an idea that even in the evil systems such as Psi-Corps or even Earth Force, there are still good people within it, and I think that's what saves it for me as well, with having Earth is actually the bad guy as well, is that thing of there are still good people there, because that relates to real life. There are still people trying to make do and trying to do the right thing, and maybe they're even unaware of how bad things actually are. And I really appreciate that in this episode, where you have the usual standard of a show, the two bad guys come onto the station and do internal investigations, but we're introduced from the very beginning that they kind of don't like each other very much, and they don't really respect one another very much. And I thought that was an interesting touch to the villain dynamic, because at this point, Rachel, we've been watching it, and when they've had more than one villain on, they've just been basically a team.
Yeah, it's main guy and henchman.
Yeah. So how did you feel about seeing this on the rewatch, of how this episode throws in this interesting dynamic?
I really enjoyed it. Like, it feels like a new take on something that is well trodden, and they set up both of those characters well enough within the episode that it feels very logical and it feels true.
Yeah. And how do you feel about seeing a nice Psycor person that isn't Talia Winters? Who's not in this episode for some reason. Feels like she should be.
Yeah.
They mention her, but she's not here. But what do you think?
I like him. And it's just like, oh, you poor boy. You're just trying to make the best out of a situation that you never wanted to be in.
Yeah, I felt sorry for him. He's one of the few Psycor people you actually, actual Psycor people who are actively in the Psycor that you feel sorry for, because he lived a life before being taken into the Corps. Talia Winters never lived a life.
No,
she was always in the Corps.
He's not indoctrinated in the same way.
In the same way.
It's just like the Psycor is a means to an end because I want to be able to serve. And since my gift appeared, this is the only way that I can do it.
Yeah.
And it makes it even stranger that Bester put him on this.
Yeah, I think it's because he seems like on paper a yes man type of role. And so he'll do what Ari says. Ari will get him to do things. I think Mr. Gray is also an interesting commentary on Ari Benzane as a character, because he did not get to be in the Earth Force properly, right? He got to train a little bit and then he got thrown out and he got into the Psycor. But he's not, as you say, indoctrinated with the Psycor belief as strongly as other Psycops and Psycor agents are. He feels like he's still got the Earth Force indoctrination, but he's in Psycor.
Yeah.
And he still holds those values, which Ari Benzane doesn't hold those values. Hence, they don't get on as well. Like, Jeffrey Combs, the way he plays it, he has such a way of riding the line of, I don't like this guy for a personal reason, but also I don't like him as a soldier, as an officer. He's not doing what I would do if
but
I was...
But he's still my commander.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting way to play it, because in another script, they would just be on the same page and they would just be the two interrogators that come in and it's like the evil psychic guy yet again. What do you think about this aspect and side of the story, John?
Well, I liked Jeffrey Combs in the role. I didn't really understand this sort of Harriman Gray character in a way, only because I don't understand what it is that he's after from Ivanova. He goes up to her, he goes into the CNC without a reason for being there. He just wants to look out the window. And I got to tell you, you can look out the window in all kinds of places on the station. I'm not sure why you got to do it there, but that's where he wants to go, to look out the window. And she basically tells him to get lost it like repeatedly. And he does not receive the message.
No.
And she's screaming at the top of her mind, get the hell away from me. I don't even want to talk to you. She's insulting him at every opportunity. And I'm like, does he like her? Does he want to ask her out on a date? Like, what is this?
I think he just wants her approval.
I think he wants her permission to do the scans.
Yeah. Because
he doesn't seem to
after
want to three do times it against
getting, the way. 3 times she tells him to get lost. You know, it's like I'm sorry, but there comes a point where like social cues he completely missed. And then he sees her in the restaurant and he goes up to her again and she tells him to get lost, you know, right after she threatens to rip off his head at the end of the first scene. I mean, he could totally misses the social cues.
I think it's a weird thing in the show. And sometimes it falls on its face. And I think it does minorly here too, that every Psycor person from Talia to Bester to Mr. Gray want to prove in some way, shape, or form that they're okay to Ivanova, someone who is the only character actively saying the Psycor isn't okay. Because Talia does the same in the first episode. Talia constantly chases Ivanova, and she does that in the show a lot too. And Bester does the same to Ivanova too. Like, he keeps going after Ivanova, for him for an antagonistic reason. But I think in the show, they do this a little, it's weird, but they keep doing it, in which there are these Psycor people who want to prove to Ivanova, the person who hates them the most, that the Psycor's actually pretty okay. Which is a hard sell in this episode, since this isn't actually about the Psycor fully. I wouldn't say this is a Psycor episode like you would with other ones. And so in the script, it feels a little lacking on that Ivanova end of the side, Ivanova's side of the thing. But I did appreciate his relationship with Ari Benzane, but I agree. I think a part of the issue is in the script, they wanted Ivanova to have this really emotional journey in which she's willing to resign and she's having nightmares. And maybe this is also the result of the recap format of this, because we already know all of her tragic stuff. So we don't really need an explanation of why she feels this way, but the script needs somebody to constantly peck at her, which is what Mr. Gray serves as. Somebody to peck at her to make her feel more and more flustered, when realistically, the way she feels and the way she acts throughout all of this would just naturally happen with the pitch of the episode, which is, we're going to scan for your loyalty.
I just want to ask some questions and clarify a few details. It's all fairly routine.
And what part does Psycor play in this routine? Regulations prohibit the use of telepaths in command-level investigation.
There are new regulations, Lieutenant Commander Ivanova. And under them, all staff must submit to telepathic scan as part of an official investigation. Command staff as well.
The hell I will. Psycor may be running the rest of the world, but I refuse
Ivanova.
To...
The Ivanova side of the story, Rachel. How do you feel about it?
It's our first proper Ivanova dream sequence, which happens a surprising number of times in this show.
Yes.
Like, it's always Ivanova that gets the dreams.
She gets dreams. Usually they're funnier than this.
Yeah.
This one's really sad and miserable.
Yeah, her becoming her mother. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so what do you think about, on the rewatch factor, knowing Ivanova fully as a character, about the reasonings why she's actually doing the stuff that she does here?
Yeah, that she's so afraid that they'll find out that she has some telepathic abilities.
Because when I first watched it, I must admit, I never picked up that that was going to be a reveal later
on.
I just thought, genuinely, she did not want them turned to her mind. But when you do rewatch it, I do get struck by that. Like, oh, yeah, she's fearing. She would
There's
fear that they
too.
Would. Yeah, it's not just, it's just that. It's and that too. That's what makes it feel... more honest on a rewatch when you see these things, because sometimes when you have reveals like this and you go back in an episode, it kind of erases what you thought the original intention was, but it doesn't erase the original intention of her resigning.
No,
it just adds to it. That's the way to describe
it. Yeah, one of the things I always tell people, especially new viewers, is that you haven't really seen Babylon 5 until you've seen it all the way through twice.
Mm-hmm.
Because the show's meant to be rewatched, right? And there's always these little things that are in the show that you only appreciate on a rewatch. And one of the examples I always bring up is well, there's actually two, and I don't know if we want to get into this or not, but one example of them is TKO, and you know, which is an episode that people bag on, and you just got to watch it for, first of all, the great little B plot about Susan's family and all that and sitting Shiva, but also the fact that Walker Smith keeps telling Garibaldi to watch his back, and then like, five episodes later he gets shot in the back.
Mm-hmm.
and you only appreciate that on a rewatch, right? The first time you watch through, you totally miss it. Same thing is true for Gray 17 is Missing, which is, you know, sometimes regarded as the worst episode of the series, but it has a thematic element that is actually much more powerful that you will not recognize the first time you watch it.
Mm.
Have you all heard this theory?
No. Well, you tell me and then I'll be like, I think I have or think I haven't. Go.
So, okay. Our lead, a character we care about, is trapped in a physical place. And it's a place of great danger. And the only way to escape is to agree to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to submit to the Zarg. And Gray 17 is Missing, right? And through the Zarg, you will achieve perfection. That happens in Gray 17 is Missing. That's also Zahadum. It's the same episode.
Yeah.
And it only happens like four episodes later. So it's an intentional foreshadowing of what happens in Zahadum.
Yeah.
And that's in Sheridan's mind as he's planning for what he's going to do. And so that episode is an essential precursor because it puts the idea of this whole thing in Sheridan's head so that he comes up with the whole nuclear plan, you know, and all that stuff. And it all comes from that episode. The people are like, no, totally skip it. There's nothing there. It's a nothing burger.
Gray 17 is Missing also has an amazing B plot that also sets up everything for the for the Minbari Civil War as well later on.
Yeah, just for the Nerun stuff, it's worth watching. But that whole A story that people bag on is critically important. There's one other thing, if I can just take a turn here, if I might, which is that on Trek Profiles, one of the things I often ask people about is how their opinions of episodes have changed as they've been watching episodes repeatedly as they get older and as they reach different points in their life. And there was something in my rewatch of this that really clobbered me right between the eyes that did not and could not the first few times I watched it. And it was obviously something which was unintentional, as they put it in the episode, or maybe it was, I don't know. Although that would be pretty dark if it was, and I'm building it up too much. So let me just get to it. And it's at one point that Ari Ben-Zane like throws his hands down on the table and he's looking right at Sinclair and he yells at him, "You're insane." And I got to tell you, folks, my heart broke because Michael O'Hare was legitimately troubled.
Yeah. And this is the last episode they filmed as well. So you said, so like a lot of the production people like JMS and a few others also knew what was going on at the same time.
Yeah. And we know that the actor was deeply, deeply troubled and was mentally ill. And so that line landed very differently for me. Once all that had come to light, knowing that they knew that as they're filming the episode, you know, and there's a season five scene that also is very similar to this, which is there's a scene where Zach Allen and Garibaldi are talking about Garibaldi's addiction, and knowing that both of them were deeply, deeply addicted while they were filming the show, while this was happening.
Yeah, JMS talks about actually writing that stuff into the show in his autobiography, like as a kind of like, hey, guys, come on, get stuff together. And yeah, I often, when we talk about season one, Rachel and I, we haven't often talked about how there are those moments of emotional impact when we know the behind the scenes with Michael O'Hare as much, because, you know, sometimes it's like, let's keep to the episode. But it is true, like when we watch this, I've always liked Sinclair. Rachel, you always met on Sinclair. You were more of a Sheridan fan. But there is a truth in, a lot of my appreciation has grown for Sinclair as a character, knowing how tough it was to actually make this season for Michael O'Hare and for JMS and co, and knowing how things panned out in real life. And so when we are rewatching this and talking about it on the pod, there is more of an appreciation for Sinclair from us than if we did this before any of that information came out. I'm like, Sinclair, to me, has always been a very decent character. I've always found him a very in-depth character from the writing standpoint. But when I did watch this episode, earlier, I was cheering for Sinclair a lot more than I think I did when I initially watched it those first few times. Because, one, I know what happened to the actor in real life. But, two, there is this factor of, I'm going to miss not having Sinclair around. Like, this is
right.
Kind of what the show was supposed to be. Like, this optimistic, in the face of everything attitude that Sinclair had. And in this episode, he's furthering this arc that we've been discussing on our podcast of one of the things that we really love about Sinclair upon a rewatch is he starts out as a cowboy, as a reckless person. He's throwing himself into the action. He's throwing himself into the fray. And it's questionable why he's doing that. And the show sits down and says, hey, why the fuck are you doing that? Why are you doing the Captain Kirk thing where you throw yourself into the action sequences and nearly die doing it? Why are you doing that? Maybe you're carrying around some trauma from war. And I like that we come this point in the show, Sinclair's not doing that shit anymore. And he's solving the crisis by just reading the rules. Just reading the rules, just figuring out the way and trying to reason with people, like reasoning with Mr. Gray and turning him around on things and pleading for the case of the Babylon 5 motto. Can we actually achieve peace? Is that actually something we can do? Sinclair's here to try to do that. And we've been talking about, you and I, Rachel, about this building of this arc of this. And I think to me, this is one of the biggest payoffs or crescendos of that, of our time with Sinclair.
Absolutely. I don't know what else to add to that, because I feel like you packaged it up very nicely. It's a very clear marker in terms of Sinclair's story.
Yeah. John, since this is a heavy Sinclair episode and it is questioning his skills as a commander, Could you tell us a bit about what you think of him as a character and like his type of leadership and what you think of him in this episode?
Yeah, I really like him. I really like his thoughtfulness and his, I almost want to say this word and it's not, it's going to sound like a criticism, but it's not, or sort of his brooding nature, where he's sort of pondering things. And I completely agree with you that I thought he was very much more of a stereotype at the beginning of the series, where he's like running around, you know, like I'm the one that has to go in and fight the crazy Membari on my own, and I got to do the other things, you know, and I'm putting myself into all this danger. And it's not until you get to And the Sky Full of Stars you realize, oh, he's unwell.
Yeah.
it's not that he's the hero guy. He's not a James T. Kirk. He's got a death wish. Unwittingly, he's wanting to die. And, you know, that awareness helps him, right? I don't think he ever really gets cured of it until season three when, you know, he comes back, you know, spoiler. But I think that really is a very different kind of lead character. And I like that here's a guy who's troubled, because one thing I really dislike as a general topic is these anti-heroes, people who watch The Sopranos and are rooting for Tony. I wanted Tony to catch a bullet in every episode. Like, he's a bad person. The world is better for his passing in the show. And the same thing is true for Walter White in Breaking Bad. These are not good people.
Yeah.
You should not root for them. If you're watching the show and you're a fan of them and you want them to succeed, I urge you to reconsider, right? And so
that's why I like Better Call Saul a lot more than Breaking Bad, because you feel a lot more empathy for a guy who's actively trying and failing to be a good person because they have an inherent flaw within them. And that's what I like about Sinclair, is he's actually succeeding, though. Garibaldi
right,
pulls
yes.
him aside and says, hey, you need to stop fucking around. You need to actually get your shit together. And every episode, he's actively trying to be the good commander, to be the idealistic idea one has of the space captain hero type. And we see that it's actually really fucking hard to do that. And you have people like Ari Benzane coming in saying, you're not actually doing it correct. Let me do it correct for you. You're fucking it up. And it's like, well, guys, give him a chance. He also wants to die.
Yeah, and I just want to say, Breaking Bad and The Sopranos are excellent shows.
Yeah.
I just want to be very clear about that. But, you know, no way am I rooting for the heroes. In this case, I like the fact that we have a much more human guy who's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to be better. He's trying to follow the rules. He's got some demons, like we all do, and he's working with it, right? And to me, it was just like I could get my brain wrapped around that, and I wanted him to succeed. And I, you know, when he has the end of his story in season three, I feel very good for him. And
yeah.
the very pinnacle of how he ends up is that one line he gives in that season three episode when he says, I am now the arrow from the bow, right? No hesitation. And I think that's what he's always wanted, because he's had all this questioning since the line, right?
Yeah.
Why am I alive? Why am I here? What is my life? Why do I even still exist? And, you know, he's in this existential crisis for years.
Am I being manipulated? Am I being used? What's the agenda here? Because that's also what's in this episode, is the ongoing questioning that outsiders, as well as he himself, have about his intentions. You were put here by the enemy. They decided to put you here. You must have some secret alliance or agenda with them, or they're using you in some way. And Sinclair questions that as well at points throughout the show, of like, am I secretly being a puppet?
How much of this is my choice?
Yeah, and he always tries to grab it by the horns and try to conquer his own destiny. And here, obviously, I love seeing Sinclair backed into a corner, and he's having to play by the rules. And there's that great line, my favorite line in the episode from Sinclair, when he's talking to Ivanova about, I found a way to get past the mind scans within the regulations. Great.
Besides, I found a way to avoid the scans within the regulations.
Are you sure?
Yes.
May I borrow your PPG to shoot myself squarely in the head?
That won't be necessary. This time.
Well, let's get into our actor's spotlight section of the show, in which we do talk about an actor that was in this episode, what we thought of their performance, what we've seen them in, anything of interest. Jeffrey Combs is obviously the person of discussion. We've mentioned Mr. Gray, but we've got to really just dive into Jeffrey Combs. Honestly, I was thinking of talking about Gregory Martin who's Ari Ben Zain, because I think he's an interesting fellow, but we have to talk about Jeffrey Combs. I mean, it's also one of the things that this episode's remembered for is Jeffrey Combs is in this? Jeffrey Combs?
So, let me stop you and ask you one question. If Jeffrey Combs had not been in all of that Star Trek, would we be talking about him in this episode?
I would, because I'm a Reanimator fan. That's what I think of Jeffrey Combs as. So if we're going to talk about Jeffrey Combs, I'm a big Reanimator fan. To me, that's who Jeffrey Combs is, as well as From Beyond. A lot of the Stuart Gordon films, I know him from those, and people love him from Star Trek and all of that, and we'll obviously talk about that. But for my history with Jeffrey Combs, when I was a small child, my parents had stacks and stacks of VHS tapes, and the one that always stood out to me was Reanimator, because of that awesome cover and the awesome green writing of Reanimator on the spine of it. And I was like, what is this movie? And it's R-rated. I wasn't allowed to watch it because it's gross. And I was like, four. And I always wanted to know what this Reanimator movie was. I'd read the back of it. We had Bride of Reanimator as well. And that's who Jeffrey Combs is to me. He's Herbert West. And later on, obviously, I saw him in DS9 and Enterprise and so on and so forth. And I loved him in those as well. But to me, my connection to him will forever be that first time I got to watch Reanimator, and he lived up to everything I wanted that cover of the VHS to be. He was mad, he was smooth, eccentric, and funny. That's the thing I think of. Jeffrey Combs is a really, like, he's really good comedic actor, which we don't really get to see in this episode of Babylon 5. He's not funny in Babylon 5. He's very serious. He's
very earnest in this.
He's very earnest, which is a very different route for him to take. But that is my minor history with Jeffrey Combs. Rachel, what about you?
I think I mainly knew him from Star Trek, and I've seen him in other things. He's another example of, oh, it's that guy.
He's a that guy actor. He turns up and it's that guy.
Like, he's done a very wide range of things, but mostly sticking to lots of sci-fi genre stuff.
Horror.
And horror stuff.
And comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about you, John? What's your kind of relationship with old Jeffrey?
So this was actually, I think, the first time I'd seen him in anything, was watching this on the VHS tapes. I've never seen Reanimator. Not that I have anything. I like horror films, but I just haven't seen that one. So I probably should check it out. But I got to say, in my show, Trek Profiles, one of the things I often talk about is this idea that I try to watch the show as much as I can within the four corners of the screen. Meaning that I don't want to take in like all these other things that fans tell me about, like what Star Trek means, or like what Gene intended, or the Federations of Utopia. Like, here's an example. The Federations of Utopia. Okay, great. Show me examples that we've seen in the four corners of the screen of this utopia. Like, don't tell me what Gene said. Don't tell me what happened at a convention. Show me examples of utopia on the screen. And I'll give you a counterexample, you know, and we can have a debate about it. And it really does limit and sort of change your perspective when you try to watch the show that way. So when you said we're going to talk about Jeffrey Combs in Eyes, I'm trying to, like, in the four corners of the screen, the Harriman Gray character is like the least interesting thing that's going on in this episode.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And so that's what I was trying to get at by asking you, like, you know, because Jeffrey Combs is great, and I love Jeffrey Combs for all the other things he's done. This is absolutely in no way negative anything about the actor. He's wonderful. But he's really just playing this very earnest sort of guy, you know, doing a part, you know, trying to do his little job in the show, in this episode. And, you know, the guy doing Ben Zain, I mean, we could talk about his acting. He's given a lot more crazy stuff to do.
Yeah.
You know, we could talk about the Yvonne of a Dream sequence. You can talk about Sinclair, you know, being in his cabin, as you talked about, you know, struggling reading the rule book. But like the Harriman Gray character, his name is literally Gray.
I kind of like that, though, because he's still doing his best as an actor and as a performer. It's
absolutely
not like he doesn't phone it in, which would be so easy to do. Like, I really do believe him.
Yeah.
And that earnestness that we keep on going back to comes through in all of those scenes where he's talking about his backstory. And, like, it doesn't get to the point where you feel sorry for him, really.
No, I think my biggest criticism is in another story in which he was more of a focus of a character, you would have that recognition or that moment of recognition between him and Ivanova of being on similar ground, but we don't really get a payoff in that way. He just says pain and then lets him get punched in the head, and that's kind of the end of his character. But
yeah,
I agree. Jeffrey Combs, every time I've seen him, he's a consummate professional. He's kind of like the C-grade Tim Curry in terms of every... And in terms of every time you see them, you're happy to see them and you know you're going to get some level of entertainment. And why I say C-grade is because Jeffrey Combs, I don't know why, I like him a lot, but he's never been in major, major big movies. Like, Tim Curry's been in big movies, you know, like, but he's always lived in TV and these B-grade, C-grade films, which is good. He's been in some stuff, but, like, I'm not saying he hasn't done work, but, like, he's always in this realm and it's always fun to see him. I've often wondered if this was a misuse of Jeffrey Combs. And then I'm thinking to myself, or am I pigeonholing him as an actor? Because, yes, I also try to look at it in the four corners as well. But there's also that thing of, hey, it's Reanimator. Hey, it's Brunt. And I'm used to him doing certain things as an actor. And here, he isn't doing those. But I'm not disappointed that he isn't playing an ominous villain or an over-the-top cartoony comedy character. Because I think Jeffrey Combs showed me something that I think I've rarely seen from him, which is a vulnerability, a scared quality, because I like Jeffrey Combs' voice. That's one of the things I really like about him as an actor.
Yeah, and he's gotten more into voice work as his career's gone on.
I mean, he just did Lower Decks recently. But what I was going to say is he has this natural shakiness to his voice, and this is one of the few times in which someone uses that to make him a scaredy cat, like wimpy kind of insecure character. Usually they use it for other means, and this is one of the few times in which I've seen him play insecure or unsure or kind of pathetic in this manner, and I think that's refreshing to the palate. It kind of shows you, hey, he can do other things. He doesn't just have to be he doesn't just have to be everyone's favorite Wayoon and all of that. He can do other things. He doesn't just have to be Herbert West, in which he's like a madman. And so I appreciate it on that level. But yes, Jeffrey Combs is a legend. He's got numerous pieces of work under his belt. Okay. I mean, he's still...
You ready for the info dump then?
Yeah, what did you look into?
Can I say one thing before you get to that, which is, you know, here's what I'll say on this is the actor is wonderful. It's a little bit like buying a Ferrari and driving it around the parking lot in first gear, right? He can do a lot more, but he got this part, and I never want to say anything about an actor taking a part, right? Because you never know when you're going to get your next gig. So he did absolutely wonderful in it. You know, there's no criticism, nothing negative to say about it. But it was a smaller part of the episode in a lot of ways, and he just did it beautifully. The counterexample or the opposite example that I always like to use for this is every time I see Andreas in Next Generation, I get mad.
Yeah,
I just get mad, and I'm like, this episode sucks. I hate this episode. I hate everything about it. Right? Because here's this actor who's capable of doing 16 million things,
and they don't use him.
And they don't use him at all. And basically, they're like, stand over there and twirl your mustache for a minute. You know, that's basically all he gets to do. So in this, at least he got to do something that was a little different as far as Jeffrey Combs did in this episode, you know, that was a little bit different from, you know, Brunt FCA, you know, and sort of the villainous sort of characters that he does. And he did it beautifully, but he really didn't get to open up and, you know, really, it wasn't the meatiest of parts, but he did what he got beautifully.
Is there a point to the story, Mr. Gray?
I just want you to know, I love the Force and respect the people like you who serve in it.
A pretty speech. Did the Colonel write this for you?
No. But he's going to insist that everyone be scanned, and it's just easier if you accept that. No, I give you my word. I'll respect your personal privacy. The only thoughts I'll be looking for are those concerned with your duties in Earth Force. And given your record, I'm certain you have nothing to fear.
As we have acknowledged, he is in DS9, but he's also in Voyager and Enterprise,
yes,
as well as Lower Decks. So he was born in 1954, and his bio on IMDb has something weird, like he grew up with an abundance of siblings.
That means he has a lot of siblings. I like that they give us that information.
I'm like, an abundance? he was born in 1954. He currently has 142 credits.
God.
His first credit was Honky Tonk Freeway as drive-in teller in 1981. So he was 27 when he first got
credit.
That's
interesting. He started. I thought, yeah, one of the early films I noted down that I have to rewatch it because I forget that he's in it is The Man with Two Brains.
Yeah.
Steve Martin movie. He's in that.
And then 85 was Reanimator. He's also into Star Trek video games.
Of course he is. Of course he is.
And one that I just really enjoyed, he was in an episode of Scooby-Doo.
Of course.
As H.P. Hatecraft.
Yes, just an overeager fan who got carried away.
Fans. Imbeciles fit only to be gnawed by rabid rats.
Yes, someone could write a book.
How about A Boy and His Fans? By Harlan Ellison and H.P. Hatecraft.
I was thinking something more along the lines of Shagul Rath Hagafar, the fan that hath no name.
Except you just named it.
Oh, start with me, Ellison.
He was actually in, just to share some interesting information, he was in a film called Dr. Mordred, I do believe, which was, a full moon picture in which at that time they had the rights to Doctor Strange because Marvel was all over the place. In the 90s when their film rights, but halfway through the production or through the production, they lost the rights to Doctor Strange, so they had to rework the entire script, and then they could make it an R-rated movie. So there is a movie out there in which you can watch Jeffrey Combs play Doctor Strange, but not actually. Like, he's in a full costume and the hair and everything. It's amazingly stupid and wonderful. And you're seeing him give that gravitas that only Jeffrey Combs could give to playing not Doctor Strange, but actually Doctor Strange. He's a legend of the field. I do find it interesting that in the world of Star Trek, people have grabbed onto him as like the guy who's always in Star Trek. But to me, there's so many other actors as well in Star Trek that have done more variety of roles than Jeffrey Combs. But Jeffrey Combs played like really memorable different characters. And I think that's the key. Like, Shran is probably one of the better things in Enterprise to me. And, you know, it's Jeffrey Combs being a blue guy with pointy antennas on his head, and yet he makes it believable.
They all have kind of these very big personalities, right? Which is what makes the Harriman Gray character so interesting for him, is that it's not, right? Because every other character, like Shran, like Brunt, you know, like the Vorta even, they have these personalities which are very, very right at the surface. And it was just nice to see him do something a little different here.
Yeah, and Herbert West is very over-the-top character.
You'll never get credit for my discovery. Who's going to believe a talking head? Get a job in a sideshow.
Eyes. That's the episode. What would you rate this out of an impeccable rating system of yum being bad and yum yum being good?
Yum yum.
Yum yum.
I give this a yum yum as well.
Yum yum.
John, where do you land? Yum being bad or yum yum being good?
It's a yum yum for me.
Yum yum.
I have no... bad things to say about this episode. I think it was well done, well executed. I thought it had a nice A story and a nice B story. It laid up some nice things for Ivanova that are very helpful on a rewatch. And it also recapped the season for newer viewers who were just tuning in at the time, which was important for TV at the time. I liked Gregory Martin as Colonel Ben Zane. I had no problem. I met guys like that when I was in the military. So he was very accessible to me as like the kind of person who might be there. I liked the political angle of it. I liked Garibaldi being caught in the middle of the A and the B stories at the same time, which I thought was just great. And I thought it was just a nice, satisfying episode of Babylon 5.
Indeed, you do. Well, let's find out what satisfying episode of Babylon 5 we'll be tackling next week.
On the next Babylon 5.
Episode 17, Legacies. Are the Mimbari pounding the drums of war? Their planet-to-planet memorial tour honoring a fallen combat hero raises suspicions aboard the Freeport dedicated to peace. It also raises Delenn's ire, leading her to take a stand against her homeland's warrior caste.
So, people, make sure to tune in for Legacies, Season 1, Episode 17. We'll be talking about that. That's one I'm looking forward to very much because I don't want to give too much away of that discussion, but one of my absolute favorite minor characters is Naroon. I love that character, and I can't wait to see him upon the rewatch. I'm very excited to talk about Legacy, so people, make sure to tune in and watch that and join us next time on the podcast. John, it was so great to have you on here and to talk to us and give us some of your really insightful real-life stories about your relationship with the show and the episode and all of this stuff. Could you please tell us all where we can find you and your podcast on the internet?
Oh, absolutely. You can find my podcast anywhere you get your audio, or you can listen online at trekprofiles.com or on Facebook Mobile as well. So I'm anywhere you want to listen, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google. I'm in all the places. And so if you want deep dive with Star Trek fans into why they love the show and what the show means to them, I am absolutely the show you are looking for. So check me out there. If you want to follow me on social media, I am most active on Twitter. Where I go by Trek Profiles, and my social media on Twitter is probably 70% Star Trek related, and about half of that 70% is related to my show. The other half is just related to general live tweets of episodes and other Star Trek content, and about the remaining 30% is general pop culture and walls, and I try to be amusing and funny whenever I can.
That's the way, isn't it? Rachel, take us out.
Oh, well, you can find us at Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast at all of those various social medias. And if you want extra content from us, you can head over and check out our Patreon.
Yes, we actually do have a Patreon where you can get those bonus contents. We are talking about the X-Men movies at the moment once a month. We finished all of the Star Trek movies and we thought, hey, we don't want to leave Patrick Stewart behind. We want to keep journeying with him. And since we're covering Babylon 5, there's often lots of comparisons between some aspects of Babylon 5 and X-Men. So we're talking about those. We are also talking about the best and worst rated episodes of Star Trek, according to IMDb. We actually talked about Shades of Grey a little while back and how we dived in and discussed how that worked as a recap episode and how it also failed. And goodness gracious.
Yes.
Yet I would rather watch that than Code of Honor. So we have that, and we give our general thoughts on other things, podcasts, movies, we've been watching TV shows. So head on over, have a fun time over there, rate and review us on whatever podcatcher you use to do so. And all of this stuff, our socials, John's socials, all this stuff will be included in the description of this episode, as is usual. So if you need to double check it, click below for all of that. John, we have our farewells that we say to each other on this show because Jakar said one time in the gathering this farewell and he never says it again, but we're saying it at the end of every single one. But, John, good eating to you.
Good eating to all of you.
Good eating to you all.
Ah, Mr. Keller!